I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is Lillian Faderman, scholar of lesbian and ethnic history and literature, whose new book biography of former San Francisco supervisor and the first openly gay elected official in California, Harvey Milk, is Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death. She's joined in conversation by author and poet Michelle T. And now join Michelle T. on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Lillian Faderman.
Hello, thanks for being here. I am really excited to introduce Lillian Faderman. We're keeping it really casual. We're like sitting here like it's not a big deal that she's here, but it feels like a very big deal. Like I should be up on the podium with like a spotlight on her. And when I was 22 years old and I first came out and I made my pilgrimage from New England to New York City Pride, and I went to my first gay bookstore, which was Oscar Wilde, which I found out in your book was started by a lover of Harvey Milk's. Yes. I found Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers sitting on the shelf, and I was immediately drawn to it. And I didn't realize how badly I needed that book to sort of give me a historical context for myself and to understand who my ancestors were, and also to give me a heads up for, you know, what was coming down the pipe when I moved to San Francisco and fell into a butch femme, you know, revolution I learned about in your book from the 60s. So that was a really important book to me, as you know, many of your books have been. Naked in the Promised Land is a stunning, incredible book that felt like a handshake through time between like femme, sex worker, lesbian, radicals, I don't know. But with Harvey Milk, she has, it's her first foray into a full-on biography, like you were just saying, something you didn't know that you would ever do. And she presents him with all of his passions and flaws, and he becomes such a real human being. And for me, somebody who sort of missed him in real life, and he's become more of an icon. It was really wonderful to get to see him sort of more on a human level. So without further ado, Lillian Faderman.
Thank you for that introduction, Michelle. And thank you for being here. So I first wrote about Harvey about 12 or 15 pages in my book, The Gay Revolution. I didn't go into his Jewish background very much, although I knew about it, of course. And I was particularly fascinated because his grandfather, who was the first generation in America, came from a shtetl in Lithuania that was right on the border of Latvia, and my mother came from a shtetl in Latvia that was 30 kilometers from the border of Lithuania. So I've always wondered if maybe 200 years ago we were somehow related. So so Yale University Press, right after the Gay Revolution came out, asked if I would like to do a biography of Harvey Milk. It took me about 10 seconds to think about it and say yes. Of course, I wanted to do that. I knew that I would be concentrating on Harvey as a gay activist and a politician, but I also wanted to look at how his Jewish background influenced him. And what I discovered is he had a very complex relationship to being Jewish. He would, practically the first thing he would say in many instances when he introduced himself was the fact that he was a New York Jew. And he would never say Jewish, he would say Jew. It was just very direct and confrontational and not euphemistic. And Harvey was certainly not in any way a euphemistic guy. So that was very much a part of his identity. But like many American Jews, he was not at all religious. He really considered himself totally secular. And yet he loved Yiddishkeit. I was told by a couple of people that I interviewed that he had his bar mitzvah picture hanging in Castro Camera, not as an indication that he had been pledged to the faith, but rather because it was his memory of his Jewish boyhood back in Long Island. He loved the sentimental things about being Jewish. He loved corned beef on rye, and he would talk all the time about how you couldn't get a decent corned beef on rye sandwich in San Francisco. He even thought in the beginning that that's the business that he and his lover Scott Smith would go into, that they would open a good delicatessen in San Francisco. He grew up in a family that spoke Yiddish, not entirely, but often, and he knew a lot of Yiddish phrases. And he would love it if he met someone who knew Yiddish and they could exchange phrases. I was told so many stories that I absolutely loved about that. But just one example, a story told to me by Anne Cronenberg, who was his aide. She said that there was an elderly Jewish woman by the name of Henrietta Abrams, who was one of Harvey's constituents. And she just loved him. She would call him her little Jewish prince. And she knew that he had a sweet tooth, so every week she would take a bus from, I think it was Cole Street, to City Hall, carrying a box of cookies that she made for her little Jewish prince, and he would usher her into the office, and Anne said then he would close the door, and she knew that they would munch cookies and just talk Yiddishkeit, just throw in Yiddish phrases in their conversation. So he was Jewish in that way, but he was Jewish in much more important ways. And I think that he took very seriously the commandment to repair the world, help repair the world, tikkun olam. And I think that was crucial to his politics. So let me start the slideshow by showing you a picture of his grandfather, the first Milk in America, but his name was Moshe Milch, not Milk. Of course, Milk in Yiddish. He was a dairyman in Lithuania in his shtetl, like Tavior the Milchiker in Shalom Aleichem's Fiddler on the Roof. He came to America without his wife and five children because he couldn't afford to bring them here. And his story is the American success story. So he went to a stepbrother that he had in Kansas City, and he kind of thought that he would become a dairyman in Kansas. And of course, he couldn't afford to buy land, which was much more expensive in Kansas than it was in his shtetl in Lithuania. And so he worked in the stepbrother's store for a while, still couldn't make enough money to bring his wife and five children. And so he decided he would go to New York. The Lower East Side by that time was crowded with immigrants. And so instead of settling on the Lower East Side, he had an aunt on Long Island. She said he could stay with her for a while. He got himself a peddler's pack, peddled around Long Island, made enough money to open a little dry goods store, sent for his wife and five kids, including Harvey's father, who was 6 years old when he arrived. He was only 6 months old when Moshe left. And then Moshe made enough money to open the first department store in their area of Long Island. They settled in Woodmere, Long Island, and he eventually invested in real estate. He became quite wealthy. I think if he returned to Yoniskis, his shtetl, they would have thought he was a nobleman. And that so often happened, I think, with people who left their shtetlach and came to the States and made good. So he became a philanthropist, and he became an activist as well. Just as one instance, there was a country club near Woodmere, the Rockaway Hunt Club, and people who were succeeding wanted to join a country club. It had been a very American thing to do since the 19th century. The only problem is the Rockaway Hunt Club wouldn't allow Jews, and so Harvey's grandfather, Mausha, started the first Jewish country club in the area on Woodmere, Long Island. So, and he was he started the co-founded, I should say, the first synagogue in Woodmere, Long Island. He really he did well and he did good too, and I think he became one of Harvey's main role models. His other role model was his mother, who was really a character. And she was, Harvey said she was sort of a hippie before there were hippies, but she was also a philanthropist and also believed in tikkun olam. She died, in fact, at the age of 62 of a heart attack that she suffered after she delivered a 24-pound turkey to a New York City settlement house so that people who wouldn't have had a Thanksgiving turkey could have one. She had a heart attack, languished in the hospital for 5 days, and died on November 27th, 1962, to the day exactly 18 years before her son died. 16 years before her son died. Something wrong with my math here. Harvey died in 78. She died in 62. And then there was the father, Bill Milk, very different from his father, Mausha, and also very different from Harvey. But he, too, had a social conscience. Just one story I'll tell you. When Harvey was about 10 years old, the Woodmere School District wanted to hire a music teacher, and a Jewish woman applied, and they refused to hire a Jew. And Harvey's father, along with another, several other Jews in the community, went to them and argued long enough to make them change their minds. So they finally hired that teacher. Harvey's ethnic identity as a Jew was very firm throughout his childhood and throughout his youth. He went to Cheder. He had a bar mitzvah, but that was sort of the end of religion for him, at least almost until his death. And the reason it was is that he figured out when he was 14 that he was gay, and he really felt that there was no synagogue at that time in the 1940s that would welcome a gay person. And so he as soon as he didn't have to go to a synagogue anymore, he didn't. And yet that Jewish identity remained. In college, he joined a Jewish fraternity. He joined Hillel. He went to Sabbath dinners and other Jewish holidays and celebrations at Hillel. He went to college, started in 1947. He was a Zionist. He joined the Intercollegiate Zionist Federation of America. And he proclaimed his Jewish identity every chance he got. He was very aware of anti-Semitism. As he was growing up on Woodmere, Long Island in the 1930s and the early 40s, there was a Nazi organization called the German American Bund that had huge rallies on Long Island. There was no way that he could not have been aware of it because his parents were so aware of it. 6 days before his bar mitzvah in 1943, the Warsaw Ghetto fell. He heard about that from his parents. And as an adult, even in San Francisco, he told people that taught him a lesson, that his parents said, when something so evil descends on you, you have to fight as the ghetto fighters did, even if it's hopeless. And I think that just became so much a part of his character, that you have to fight against the horrors of injustice, even if it seems hopeless. the Holocaust became a major metaphor in his speeches. And I ran across so many of his speeches in which he uses the Holocaust as an example and a warning to gay people to what could happen if you're not vigilant, if you don't start fighting in the beginning. He was very active in the battle against Proposition 6, which was the Briggs Initiative, which said that if you were homosexual or if you said anything nice about homosexuals, you could not teach in the public schools. And in his speeches about how it's important to defeat Proposition 6, he would keep returning to the Holocaust as a metaphor and a simile and an example. In one speech, just to give you one instance, he said, just as Proposition 6 would prevent gay people from teaching in the public schools, so 45 years ago did the German law prohibit Jews from teaching or holding any other civil service position. So that was his major metaphor, and it was always on his mind. So in 1973, he first ran for office. He was very aware of himself, even then, as part of an ultra-liberal Jewish tradition that fought for all of the oppressed. In his speeches, he made it clear that he was a champion not only of gay people, but also of workers and racial and ethnic minorities and the disabled and senior citizens and everyone who suffered discrimination. Sometimes he would say, and he said it sort of wryly, that we Jews know that we can't allow discrimination if for no other reason than we will someday be on that list. So again, he learned from the story of the Holocaust. He was always aware of himself as a double outsider, not only as a gay person, but also as a Jew. And he never let go of those sympathies for the outsider. Just a couple of instances. Early in his run, he was asked to fill out a questionnaire for a group that was doing a voter pamphlet. And he wrote on the questionnaire that the government wasted taxpayers' money by hiring police to arrest people for victimless crimes, and that same money had to go to things such as expanding health care for the elderly and the poor. It had to go to expanding Operation Bootstrap so that minorities and young people could be helped to start businesses. It had to go to help hard drug addicts get well again instead of throwing them into prison. He was asked one question on that questionnaire about civil rights, and he said, quote, for all, especially gay, especially black, especially Mexican, especially Oriental. So his point was that he was not simply a gay candidate, but he was a candidate that was going to fight for all those who were discriminated against. So he lost the first race for supervisors. I think San Francisco just wasn't ready for this guy with a New York accent who had just barely come to San Francisco. He'd only been here for a year, who looked quite a bit like a hippie. He had long hair. He tied it back in a ponytail. But he realized that he had to change his style if he was going to run again. What a metamorphosis. This was in 1975 when he ran again for office. But he made it clear that although his style had changed, his values had not changed. This time he was really much more savvy in getting endorsements. He managed to get endorsements from organized labor. He really understood how to come across to organized labor. He got endorsements from ecologists for the San Francisco Tomorrow Club. He got endorsements from various African-American groups, called black groups in those days, Latino groups, Asian groups. He really appealed to senior citizens. They loved his promise that he would stop the police from harassing innocent people who were not bothering anyone else. They were victimless crimes, that is, gay people, and that money would go towards helping senior citizens, improving health care in San Francisco. So he barely lost that election. There were six seats and open, and he came in seventh, and that gave him courage to run again. So he ran again in 1976 for the assembly. He lost that too. Three strikes, but he was definitely not out.
You're listening to LGBT scholar Lillian Faderman, whose new biography is Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death. She's joined in conversation by author and poet Michelle T. on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
In 1977, the procedure for electing supervisors in San Francisco had changed. Before, it was a citywide election. In 1977, it became a district election. He ran in a district that included the Castro and Haight-Ashbury and Noe Valley and places that already knew him and loved him, and he won. He was a shoo-in. Harvey was in office for only 11 months, and in November of that year, he took office in January of 78. In November of 78, he was killed by a homophobic fellow supervisor, Dan White. So why, he was only serving in office 11 months, as I said, he's been dead for 40 years, why does he still matter? I don't think it's just the drama of his martyrdom. I think he matters also because of the important things he did. I think he did a lot of what can be described as repairing the world in those 11 months. On a local level, he fought for rent control. He fought against the expansion of the San Francisco airport because he thought that more traffic would come about if the airport would be expanded, more pollution, more noise. It's really ironic that, as I'm sure you all know, a terminal has been named after him. I don't know what he would have thought about that one. He accomplished a lot, too, that resonated far beyond San Francisco. For example, he fought for the U.S. State Department to close its South African consulate in San Francisco in protest against South African apartheid, and he got the Board of Supervisors to vote that the city would not do business with banks and corporations that did business with South Africa as long as apartheid existed. San Francisco was the first city, and this started a municipal movement. By 1990, 112 cities and counties around the United States had divested from South Africa until the apartheid policy was no more. Of course, he was especially important to the gay community. He got the Board of Supervisors to pass the country's most comprehensive, most exhaustive gay rights bill at a time when other cities were repealing their bills. Some of you may be old enough to remember Anita Bryant and the damage that she did in Miami. Their gay rights ordinance was repealed there, in St. Paul, Minnesota, and Wichita, Kansas, and Eugene, Oregon. San Francisco passed this very strong bill that also had teeth in it that said that people had a right to sue if they were discriminated against on the basis of their sexual orientation. And then he did other things that I think was vital for our progress as an LGBT community, as we call ourselves now. In those days, we were a gay and lesbian community. But Harvey really believed that gay adults had to take moral responsibility for gay youth. This was unheard of in the 1970s. The existing organizations from the beginning, organizations such as Mattachine and Daughters of Bilitis, and then the Society for Individual Rights and other organizations that cropped up through the years, they all had a no one under 21 policy. You couldn't even subscribe to their magazines. And these were not pornographic magazines. These were magazines about how homosexuals had to fight for civil rights. But if you were under 21, you couldn't subscribe. The reason for that, I think, is obvious, because one of the things that society leveled against us for so many years was the crazy bugaboo, the stereotype that homosexuals are people who lurk in the shadows ready to pounce on some 14-year-old kid. And because of that, these homosexual organizations really felt obliged to have a no one under 21 policy. Harvey said there are more important things to worry about. Don't worry about these dumb accusations. We have to help young people who get thrown out of their house because they're gay, who can't find a job because they're gay. When he said that, he was the first elected politician ever in the history of this country to have said something like that, that gay youth have to be helped. Now it's obvious. Now all gay organizations, all LGBTQ organizations understand that. There isn't a gay center in the country that doesn't have a program for LGBTQ youth. Even organizations as relatively conservative as the Human Rights Campaign concerns itself with the welfare of LGBTQ youth. But Harvey was the first to make that point. So the last year of Harvey's life was glorious because he was just such a force on the Board of Supervisors, but it was also a very difficult year, in several ways really terrible. He had wonderful victories, but he also had real tragedies that last year. One was the fact that he was constantly broke. He couldn't pay his bills. The Board of Supervisors position was a half-time position. It was taken usually by people who, like Carol Ruth Silver, who was a lawyer. She had a law practice while she was on the Board of Supervisors, or Dianne Feinstein, who had a very wealthy husband, but it was virtually impossible to live on a half salary. It was $9,600 a year. In those days, even, it would have been on the poverty line. And then he had put so much of his money into the four campaigns and put all of his time and energy into those campaigns. And so Castro Camera sort of went down the hill, and finally it closed, so he couldn't get any income out of Castro Camera. He had to borrow money from friends. When he died, he actually had a check in his pocket for $3,000 that a friend had lent him so he could pay his rent and eat that month and put a little bit into paying back his debt. But that wasn't the worst of the tragedies. The worst of the tragedies was that in August, Jack Lira, the man that he had lived with for a couple of years, committed suicide and left really gruesome suicide notes. And so maybe it was the accumulation of those terrible things that drove Harvey astonishingly to a synagogue for the high holidays, probably for the first time since he left his parents' home. He went to the gay synagogue in San Francisco, Shahar Zahav, and the rabbi at that synagogue later said he went there for both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And the rabbi who officiated later said that after the service on Yom Kippur, Harvey went up to him and thanked him and said how good it was to finally be home with his Jewishness. But I'm going to end my presentation by saying that in terms of what Harvey stood for and how well he understood the notion of tikkun olam, I think he never stopped being at home with his Jewishness. So I'll stop here.
Thank you. Luk is so good. Don't you just want to live in her living room and have her talk to you about life every night before bed? Can you talk about what your process was like? I'm so curious how you amassed all of these personal anecdotes and these wonderful details that really brought him alive in the book.
The first thing I did is there is a several fabulous Harvey Milk collections right here in San Francisco at the San Francisco Public Library in the History Room. And I worked with all of them. There's the Harvey Milk Archive Scott Smith collection. Scott Smith was the person who was the most important in Harvey's life. Harvey lived with him and started Castro Camera with him. They broke up a few years before Harvey's death, partly because Harvey was so involved in running for politics, and Scott just got fed up with Harvey being constantly out campaigning that Scott couldn't stand it anymore. But they loved each other for the rest of Harvey's life. In any case, Scott inherited all of Harvey's papers. Scott died of AIDS, so Scott's mother inherited the papers, and his mother wonderfully gave those papers, all of those papers, to the San Francisco Public Library Harvey Milk Archive Scott Smith Collection. Randy Schiltz did a terrific book on Harvey Milk in 1982, and he had done voluminous interviews with people who are no longer alive. He only used a tiny fraction of those interviews in his book, and I got to go through all of those interviews, and I was able to really fill in a lot of gaps through the interviews and material that he didn't use. There's another very important collection by Mike Weiss, who wrote a book about Dan White and the double murders at City Hall. And Mike Weiss did interviews with people who were alive then and are no longer alive, and he gave me permission to look through all of those interviews, and I found invaluable material there. And then I interviewed a number of people who graciously gave me their time, people who were close to Harvey, like Cleve Jones and Danny Nicoletta, who worked in the store, and Ann Cronenberg, who was Harvey's aide, and Tom Ammiano, who was very inspired by Harvey to run for politics himself. And then I found several family members who were really helpful. There was one family member, a man by the name of Sam Mandela, whose mother was Harvey's aunt, and she saw herself as the repository of the history. And so it was from Sam, the mother's no longer alive, but it was from Sam that I got some wonderful photographs, such as the picture of Moushe Milch, the grandfather, that I don't think anyone outside of the family had ever seen before. So I was thrilled to get that. I interviewed a number of other family members, such as Michael Salem, who was a second cousin to Harvey, who is famous in his own right, but he said that it was Harvey who really gave him good business advice. Michael's father had a store in New York. He called himself Hosier to the Stars. And he sold stockings to people like Greta Garbo and just, you know, all sorts of luminaries of the era. And then women stopped wearing stockings, and he sort of went out of business. But Michael took over the business, and he noticed that a lot of his orders were for these huge sizes, and he didn't think women And of course, they were people who were called in those days female impersonators. And he thought this would be a great business. It's kind of like the Kinky Boots story. Are you all familiar with that? So Michael did that for many years. He just recently retired. But he said that Harvey was the one who gave him business advice about how to advertise and really set him up. So I was fortunate to be able to do about 50 interviews with people who knew Harvey, people who were just customers in Harvey's store, several family members, and that was my process.
Oh, great. What does his family, how do they regard him? Like, do they understand that he's this huge legacy, and what do they think of that?
Yeah, the people I interviewed all understand that he's this huge legacy. He had a very contentious relationship with his brother. I was told by someone very close to Harvey at the time that when Harvey ran for office, he asked his brother if he would help fund the campaign. And his brother said, are you kidding? Hell no, and hung up on him. So that was the end of that. And Harvey wrote the brother out of his will specifically. There's a clause saying that nothing is to go to the brother who's no longer alive, of course. But I don't think the brother understood who Harvey was. When Harvey announced that he was running, apparently the brother said to other family members, and the brother admitted that to the newspapers after Harvey's death, that's just Harvey being Harvey again, meaning that somebody who wants the limelight and couldn't take him seriously. But the family members that I interviewed, I don't know if they understood at the time how mm-hmm. important he was, but they certainly do see him as a figure to be very proud of, and they are very proud of him. He never came out to his parents. I think his mother probably knew. I was told that she knitted matching afghans for him and Joe Campbell, who was his lover in the 1960s. They lived together, never talked about it, though, and then she died in 1962. His father didn't know. He had a difficult relationship with his father. His father lived until 1976, and of course Harvey's name was in the newspapers because he was one of the first out gay male candidates in the country. But by that time, the father was blind and wasn't reading newspapers, so the father never read about it. But after the father's death, I think Harvey really understood that Harvey lost something by not telling his parents who he really was. He never had a close relationship with his father because he had to hide something. And so one of Harvey's major messages was that we have to come out. If we're lesbian or gay, he said we have to come out to everyone. He specified to not only our parents, but our siblings and all our family members and our neighbors and people where we work and people who are the wait staff at the restaurants where we eat. And he was so right about that. And now most of us have come out. And because of that, I think public opinion has really changed. You can't think that a homosexual is someone who lurks in the shadows ready to pounce on a 14-year-old if it's your son or your daughter or your beloved neighbor or your fellow employee that you like so much. So it's been vital. And he understood that. That became his major message in the couple of years that he survived after his father died.
Because I know Harvey Milk's political, I know him as a politician, as an activist, I was really struck reading that, like, that chapter of his life came kind of later. Like, he had had this full life doing all kinds of other things before yes. he even kind of got the idea to run for office, which seemed at the time almost like a whimsical idea.
Yeah. The subtitle of my book is The Lives and Death of Harvey Milk, or Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death. People sometimes, if they're writing about it, they say, don't you mean life? But no, it's lives, because he had so many different metamorphoses. he was a jock in college. In the Navy, he was a deep sea diver, and he then trained naval deep sea divers. He got out, and he became a high school teacher. And I do several different kinds of presentations. In another presentation, I have a picture of him in the yearbook of the high school where he taught. He is so buttoned down with his hair just slicked down in a very tight tie and this tight suit. And then he didn't like that very much. He went to Texas to try to make his fortune. I have a great picture of him in Texas wearing jeans and an open collar shirt and looking very casual, but so different from the way he looked when he was a teacher. Couldn't make his fortune in Texas, came back to New York, worked on Wall Street as a securities analyst, and again looked very different from his other presentations. And then he fell in love with a young man who was a stage manager for Little Theater and hung around with a hippie crowd, and Harvey became a hippie with very long hair and a huge mustache and smoked pot a lot in those days.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is LGBT scholar Lillian Faderman, whose new biography is Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death. She's joined in conversation by author and poet Michelle T. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And then he became involved in the theater. He was actually an associate producer for one play on Broadway. He worked with Tom O'Horgan, who was the director of Hair and Jesus Christ Superstar. So he had a whole Broadway career looking very much like a hippie. Then he came to San Francisco, didn't know what he would do, opened up the small business with his lover at the time, Scott Smith, opened Castro Camera. And then the Watergate hearings happened, and he absolutely hated Nixon, thought Nixon was a crook from the beginning. Harvey wasn't so interested in being a businessman, so they lived upstairs from Castro Camera. They had a little TV set upstairs. Every morning he would lug the TV set downstairs to Castro Camera, put it on a chair, sit opposite the chair, and all day long he would listen to the Watergate hearings. And Scott Smith said that people would come into the store, they would see this guy with long hair, dark circles under his eyes, staring at the television set, screaming at John Mitchell and John Dean, you lying blank blank at the top of his lungs. So that happened, and that made him think that maybe he needed to go into politics. But a few other things happened. One was that a teacher came to the store, an elementary school teacher, and she said she wanted to rent a slide projector because she wanted to show her students some slides. And Harvey said, "You mean to tell me your school doesn't have any projectors?" And she said, "Well, yes, we have a couple, but you have to put your name on a list at least a month in advance because there are only two projectors for the whole school." And Harvey was furious with that. He said more money has to go to the school so that teachers could have a projector to show their kids slides when they wanted to. And so that was something else that happened in 1973 that made him decide he wanted to run for office. So it wasn't exactly on a whim, but
right.
I think he also, this is not to diminish who he was and what he did. I think all politicians have to have something of what I'm about to say in them. He loved the limelight. There's a story that his brother actually told that I thought really gave me an insight into one little aspect of Harvey. When Harvey was 8 or 9 years old, he really liked to go to the Woodmere movie theater for the Saturday matinees. And it wasn't the Three Stooges that he liked. It was the fact that the manager of the theater, before the movie started, would have a raffle for the kids. And the kid who had the winning ticket got to run up on stage and bow and mug. And Harvey just lived to have the winning ticket, not for the Dick Tracy wristwatch, but just to get to that stage to bow and mug. And I think for his brother, that really explained who Harvey was. Well, he was much more complicated than that, but there was that element in him always. He loved the stage. He loved being an actor, as he was very briefly. He was so comfortable with audiences. He had a charisma. He had stage presence. But that was certainly part of who he was, too.
I was struck also by his sort of the progression of his politics and the way that they sort of morphed, that he started out as sort of like crazed libertarian, like.
Yes, and exactly. Then, yeah. He was a Goldwater supporter in 1964. But it wasn't the aspects of Goldwater, like not wanting money to go into health care or whatever, that he liked. It was that Goldwater was truly a libertarian, and Goldwater said that the government had no right in people's bedrooms, and Harvey liked that. The term libertarian hadn't been invented yet. It wasn't a term until the early 1970s, but those were the politics that Harvey really appreciated. And Goldwater continued to say wonderful things about how the government had no business snooping into people's bedrooms. When there was a question about homosexuals, I guess Goldwater would have said, serving in the military, Goldwater's response was, "I don't care if they are straight, I just care if they shoot straight," which was a wonderful libertarian response. So that's what Harvey liked about Goldwater. Mm-hmm. He hid that part of his history when he became a politician, but nevertheless it was true. He was a Goldwater supporter in 1964.
I imagine he would be really shocked at what San Francisco looks like today, because he was so anti-development.
Yes,
really,
yes.
Way back before. Yes. Would you speak a little bit to that? He was. Yeah. He had a really strong sort of class consciousness.
Yes. His love for San Francisco was the fact that San Francisco was made up of neighborhoods, and they were small neighborhoods. They were real communities. And one of the things that he was suspicious about Dianne Feinstein about is that he thought, and he accused her of being in the pocket of the real estate developers. He really was opposed to development, opposed. One of the first things he did on the Board of Supervisors is vote against this proposition to expand the airport, as I mentioned. In fact, it was, I believe it was his very first vote on the Board of Supervisors, and he hadn't yet figured out how you have to be able to count to six. There were 11 people on the Board of Supervisors, so he got two other people to vote with him, and of course they lost, and the San Francisco airport expanded and expanded and expanded and continues to expand, and now has a terminal named after him.
So funny. It's San Francisco always, like, liberal politicians look really conservative here, and because it's such a radical city, which is something that's so great about it. I think a lot about how individuals who experience racial and ethnic oppression and violence often have their family of origin to sort of catch them and sort of validate what they're going through and, like, create a framework for oppression that, like, yeah, there is racism, there's anti-Semitism, there's people out in the world that, like, work against us, and here's what we have to do. And that queer people generally don't have that. And the family is often a source of that oppression. So I was wondering how... growing up in the household where he had to be like hipped to oppression helped him as a gay man like yeah. be so out during yeah. that time period.
Yeah, he didn't, as I said earlier, of course, he couldn't confide in his family. He realized that he was gay by the time he was 14. He had his first sexual experiences at the age of 14, as he talked about very openly. And what he wrote later on is that as soon as he understood he was gay, home was never home again to me. And he really had to find a home, and he felt that he found it in San Francisco. He found it in the Castro. I think that he was so determined to help create gay community here, not just a place where gay people could gather in the Castro, but a real community that had real power and really had rights, because he felt he had no community back home. Mm-hmm. So this became his community, and I think his experience of not only Jewish discrimination, but gay oppression back home made him particularly sensitive to how important it was to help create community.
Mm-hmm. It was disheartening but familiar to read about all the queer infighting that happened around
yes.
Harvey Milk. I had no idea.
Yes.
Gays hated Harvey Milk.
Yes.
But I thought gays only loved Harvey Milk.
Well,
but
not,
in fact...
Some hated Harvey
yeah,
Milk.
Yeah,
yeah. What happened is that... So he came here in 1972, and in 1973 he decided he would run for the Board of Supervisors. So there was a club in San Francisco called the Alice B. Toklas Memorial Democratic Club, which was a gay and lesbian Democratic club that would support gay-friendly candidates. They supported Dianne Feinstein, who was gay-friendly from the beginning. She was the first politician that actually went to a gay organization, to the Society for Individual Rights, to ask for their support in 1969, and she got it. So she was very gay-friendly. But they supported George Moscone, the Alice B. Toklas Club. They supported Willie Brown. And, they supported the Burtons, Phil and John Burton, gay-friendly politicians. So Harvey comes to Jim Foster, who was a very conservative-looking gay man who was the head of the Alice B. Toklas Club, and says, "I'm running for supervisor, and I would like your support." And so Harvey still looks like a hippie, long hair, not tied back in a ponytail at that time, but just long and a great big mustache and wearing denims. And here's Jim Foster in a suit and tie. And Jim Foster said that he looked at this guy with a New York accent and looking as he looked, and he thought to himself, "Who is this Mr. Yo-Yo?" And what he said to Harvey, because Harvey had not been active in the gay community, he just arrived the year before, what he said to Harvey is that we have a saying in the Democratic societies here: you don't get to dance unless you put up the chairs. I've never seen you putting up the chairs. And Harvey still didn't get it. He said, I'm going to support the gay community. And Jim Foster said, "We're like the Catholic Church. We accept converts, but we don't make them pope the next day." So he was just not going to bend. And the Alice B. Toklas Memorial Democratic Club really worked against him and did some nasty things. I got some stories from members of the Alice Club. One of them told me a story gleefully, and he didn't seem particularly contrite even to this day. But his story was that when Harvey ran, I think it was for the 76 election for assembly, he had his helpers go around to the residences in the Castro district and other areas like the Haight-Ashbury, do it at 1 a.m. before the bars closed at 2, and hang up these door hangers on people's signs that said Harvey Milk for Assembly. And this guy who'd been a member of the Alice Club told me that at 1:30, Alice Club members went around to all of the same houses and took the door hangers off because they were just so opposed to Harvey's running for office. They did other terrible things. I interviewed Elaine Noble, who was actually the first out person to win public office in 1974. Elaine Noble became won office for the Massachusetts. She was a state representative in Massachusetts. So she was invited to San Francisco by the Alice Club. Didn't know exactly why she was invited, but she was running again, and they said they would support her, and they would have a fundraiser in San Francisco for her. A lesbian group would have a fundraiser, so she came. Jim Foster, this was in 76, Jim Foster, who knew her, said, "Let me take you to lunch tomorrow." He picked her up the next day, and he said, "Do you mind if we stop by? I want you to meet this really nice guy." Took her to Art Agnos's office. Art Agnos was running against Harvey for the Assembly. Jim Foster had his camera with him. Elaine Noble shook hands with Art Agnos. Jim Foster took a picture of it. Afterwards, Jim Foster said, when they were in the car going to lunch, said to Elaine Noble, "So do you like him, Art Agnos?" And Elaine said, "Yeah, he's a nice guy." And a few days later, there was this big ad in the San Francisco gay papers, a picture of Elaine Noble shaking hands with Art Agnos, and it said that she endorsed him over Harvey Milk. You just get a nasty trick like that. Elaine Noble, whom I interviewed, said that she was so upset and was going to protest. And Kevin White, who was the mayor in Boston where she lived, said it would make it even worse if she protested, and so she didn't. But my point is that was how much the parts of the gay community did not like Harvey. They simply didn't trust him because they saw him as a newcomer, even though in 1973, it's true, he hadn't yet put up the chairs. But by 1977, he put up every chair in sight. He really worked hard to win the trust of the gay community. And he did win the trust of most of the gay community, but never of the Alice Club.
Mm. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was LGBT scholar Lillian Faderman, whose new biography is Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death. She was joined in conversation by author and poet Michelle T. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Merton is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.